which is our second case for today, 00-2180, Industry to Industry, Inc. versus Hillsman Modular Molding, Inc. And at the podium is Attorney David H. Hutchinson, representing Hillsman Modular Molding, Inc. Mr. Hutchinson.
May it please the court, my name is Dave Hutchinson, and I represent the defendant, respondent, petitioner in this case, Hillsman Modular Molding, Inc. Your Honors, this case raises the basic issue whether the Wisconsin legislature, when it enacted Section 134.93, intended to provide corporations as well as persons with a statutory cause of action under the provisions of that statute, together with providing corporations with the extraordinary remedies set forth in subsection 5, including up to 200% punitive damages and the right to recover actual attorney's fees in a case that would otherwise be a basic breach of contract case. Now, this issue was raised specifically in the context where, when the legislature defined principal for purposes of Section 134.93, the legislature defined a principal as including a variety of different business entities. But when the legislature defined who it was that could acquire independent sales representative status, the legislature exclusively defined an independent sales representative as a person. Now, our basic position is that the court should look at the plain language of the statute first, and specifically the contrast between the definition of principal, which includes a variety of business entities, and the definition of independent sales representative. And I think the court will conclude that when the legislature used the word person to define an independent sales representative, the legislature actually meant a person. I think bottom line here is that it is illogical to conclude that the legislature actually intended to include the same business entities in both the definition of principal and the definition of independent sales representative, but that the legislature simply chose to use different terms to identify those same business entities. I think it's much more reasonable to conclude that, by contrast, where the legislature defined independent sales representative as a person, by contrast with the definition of principal, where the legislature included a variety of different business entities, the logical conclusion is that in that context, the legislature actually meant person.
Counsel, let me ask you a policy type question. Your position is that a corporation is not a person within the meaning of the statute, correct?
Correct.
Why would the legislature choose to treat corporations different than people, or than a person, a natural born person, for purposes of the extraordinary remedies provided in this statute?
I think in this particular statute, I think the original purpose for the statute was to extend wage claim type remedies, or those remedies that are provided by Chapter 109, to individuals who are independent contractors and who do not otherwise have wage claim type remedies. And specifically, I would point to the court, as the court is well aware.
But corporations can have wage type remedies.
I did not understand you.
Corporations can have, as they do here, wage type remedies.
Well, I'm
trying to determine a logical reason why the legislature would distinguish between the two.
I think it is because under Chapter 109 was what was the chapter that was originally to be amended by what became Senate Bill 226, and Chapter 109 only applies to employees. Employees obviously are individuals. I think the purpose of this legislation was to expand the rights of individuals as employees to those individuals who are independent contractors and therefore do not have the rights of employees. In fact, if the court would look at the original definition, as I'm sure the court is aware, originally this bill was intended to amend both Chapter 109 with respect to wage claims and Chapter 135 with respect to the Fair Dealership Law. Ultimately, a Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1 became adopted, and what the outcome of that was that Section 134.93 was enacted. But in the original bill, the legislature defined commission salesperson basically as a person who would not otherwise have the rights set forth in Chapter 109.03 as an employee, quote, because the person is an independent contractor rather than an employee, end quote. I think that is the fundamental purpose of this legislation. It was, from the outset, intended to provide persons, individuals, with the rights of employees who would not otherwise have those rights. Now, what the Court of Appeals did in this case was the Court of Appeals looked only at the definition of independent sales representative and read the provisions of 990.01 subsection 26 into the word person contained in the definition of independent sales representative. Now, in doing so, I think the Court of Appeals looked at that definition as an isolated provision and did not attempt to look at the definition of independent sales representative in the context of the rest of the statute. And I think that was contrary to this court's ruling in the case of Country Motors versus Friendly Finance. Country Motors versus Friendly Finance was a case where this court was called upon to construe a usury statute that provided for a statutory cause of action. And in the case of Country Motors, this court recognized that not only should the court look at the language of the particular statute that was before the court, which was a usury statute that provided for a statutory cause of action to a borrower, but that the court should look at the entire usury statutory scheme, and in so doing, the court determined whether or not it would be logical in the context of the entire usury statutory scheme to see if the provisions of Section 990.01, subsection 26, should be read into the word person. Also in Country Motors, this court looked at the legislative history leading up to the enactment of the various usury statutes, and I think that's what this court should do in this case as well. In this case, if the court examines the legislative history, the court will see that as I said, I think the fundamental purpose of the legislation at the outset was to provide rights to individuals who don't have rights otherwise under the Chapter 109 as employees. There was initially in the original legislation a particular bill or a particular section, Section 33, which specifically provided with respect to those provisions which would have been under Chapter 135, that the word person would be defined as person is defined in Section 135.02, subsection 6 in the Fair Dealership Law, where person is specifically defined to include corporations. That particular provision was entirely eliminated from the ultimate statute as it was enacted. And I think it's important that the court take a look at the legislative history, which is included in the appendix of the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers Agents, who are sitting here as amicus arguers. In their appendix, there is a memo from the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association, which were actually promoting the adoption of what became Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1. And the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association, which is a manufacturers trade association, specifically wanted to restrict And particularly I'm referring to, for the court's assistance, the appendix page 45 of the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers and Agents. And specifically, they include in their appendix a memo from the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association that is commenting on Section 2, which I explained to the court was the original definition of commissioned salesperson. And then in the fourth paragraph down, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association states, quote, "We believe a clearer and narrower definition of commissioned salespersons is contained in the Illinois Commission Protection Act," the attached. And so I think it's clear that the folks that were actually promoting what became Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1 were in fact attempting to further restrict the language of commissioned salesperson to persons.
We don't
know. When I read, talking from pages 19 and 22, that wasn't the impression that I got. The argument was being made that the sales representative Moody's Food Corporation, what you're saying is that they got the wrong, I don't want to use the word spin on that document, which you prefer.
That's true. I mean, frankly, I think they, who had this particular document in their possession, knew full well what the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association was in fact promoting. As I understand the arguments of the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers Agents is that, look, you shouldn't be all that concerned with the fact that there was originally a provision in the bill that specifically said person was to be defined as person as defined in section 135.02 subsection 6, which says person includes corporations. You shouldn't be all that concerned about the elimination of that provision from the ultimate act, because that was eliminated in one fell swoop with the adoption of the language from the Illinois statute, which was promoted by the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association. But what I'm saying is the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association were promoting that language for the express purpose of even further restricting the applicability of the statute. And one thing that's abundantly clear is that there is nowhere in the legislative history any sort of comment that Section 990.01 subsection 26 would apply in any way. That there's nothing mentioned in that section. And there's nothing mentioning this Illinois case of M.S. Klein. In fact, the provisions that were attached to the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association memo doesn't comment on the M.S. Klein case whatsoever. So, I mean, from the perspective of the people that were actually promoting the adoption of Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1, they were attempting to further restrict the language and applicability of Section, what became Section 134.93.
But we don't interpret statutes by reference to what the lobbyists think they're getting, do we?
I think the question is, what was the legislative intent?
Is confined to the language of the statute.
I think
interpreted in the context of Section 990.01.26, which defines persons for use in all of the statutes on the books, right? Unless
I think
there is a manifest intent to the contrary on the face of the statute.
Yeah, I mean, what the Court of Appeals did was the Court of Appeals looked strictly at independent sales representatives and said this provision has the word person in it, therefore we should apply this section, which applies unless it's contrary to the manifest intent of the legislature. But I think to determine the manifest intent of the legislature, the court should look at the language of the entire statute. And in fact, when this court had precisely the same issue in the Country Motors case, this court said not only was it going to look at that particular usury statute, which provided for a statutory cause of action, but it was going to look at the entire usury statutory scheme to see if it was logical in the context of the entire usury statutory scheme to read the words partnerships, associations, and bodies, corporate and politic, into the word person. So, I mean, I think, and then also in the Country Motors case, this court looked at the legislative history leading up to the usury statutes. I mean, I think in order to determine manifest intent, the court should be looking at the plain language of the statute, as well as the legislative history leading up to the enactment of the statute.
What does manifest intent mean? I know what intent means. I don't always know what it is, but I know what it means. But here we're asked to look at the manifest intent. So us means something different than intent. What does manifest intent mean?
Well, I've seen cases. I looked at that issue also. I mean, obviously, and I have found cases that are cited in my reply brief that sometimes this court uses the phraseology manifest intent. Sometimes it uses legislative intent, the manifest legislative intent. I think what it means is the apparent intent of the legislation as determined by the court, given the language of the statute and given the legislative history leading up to the statute.
Well, so that's what the fight is, because we know that we're not just looking for intent. I mean, we look at intent and we look at the words of the statute. We look to the legislative history, and we look to all sorts of statutory maxims in helping us to discern the intent of the legislature. But here we're asked to find the manifest intent. And I suppose the fright in part is, does the manifest intent mean, as you say, the apparent attempt? Or does manifest intent mean the obvious, the plain on its face intent? What does manifest mean? That's our guiding light in this case. We have to know what the manifest intent means. I don't know, when you define it apparent intent, I mean, that's what we're doing when we're trying to discern the intent. So what manifest is something different?
Well, in my mind, if you're attempting to discern the manifest intent of the legislature, or if you're attempting to discern the intent of the legislature, your methodology to determine the intent is the same.
In this case, there are different definitions. But for instance, if you use the Webster unabridged definition, manifest means clearly visible to the eye or obvious. Now, if you use that definition of manifest, your analysis and your analytical framework is a bit different.
Well, I guess what I would come back to is, specifically, and certainly I've thought about this specific issue, certainly what this court did in the case of Country Motors, this court was faced with, in my mind, essentially the same issue, whether or not Section 990.01, subsection 26, should be read into the word person used in a usury statute to provide for a statutory cause of action. And I think in that case, what the court did was look not only what the court ultimately determined what was the legislative intent of these usury statutes, and it did so in the context of looking at the entire usury statutory scheme. So, I mean, I think that which should be the guiding precedent in this case. I don't think, in my mind, that whether it's referred to as manifest intent or legislative intent or legislative intent, that it makes much difference. I think what is necessary is to reach a conclusion. Is it logical that the legislature actually intended to include the same business entities in both the definition of principal and the definition of independent sales representative, but simply chose to use different terms to identify these same business entities?
It seems to me you're reading out of the statute the word manifest, inconsistent with the manifest intent. Manifest doesn't mean anything to you.
Well, I mean, to me, what it means is apparent. I don't think because it's manifest intent, I think that the key to the applicability of Section 990.01 with respect to any statute is the application of one of the provisions of that statute consistent or inconsistent with the intent of the legislature in enacting the basic statute that is under the court's review for construction.
Well, indeed, what you've just said, is it consistent or inconsistent with the intent of the legislature? However, 990.01 reads inconsistent with the manifest intent. So you are reading that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying you're reading it out.
In the cases that I have reviewed that dealt with this issue, I didn't understand that the court was making a huge distinction between intent of the legislature and manifest intent of the legislature. As I say, I don't recall that this court particularly commented on that aspect of Section 990.01, subsection 26, when it ruled in the case of Quinter Motors versus Fenton Finance. I think what the court did was try to determine what was the legislative intent and whether it made sense in the context of that case to read the provisions of 990.01 into the statute.
What bad policy consequences would occur if we interpreted a person to include corporations?
I think as a bad policy, it would be, one, I think inconsistent with what was the intent of the legislature in enacting the statute. I think that the legislature was attempting to provide these, in my mind, extraordinary remedies exclusively to persons who are individuals. And so, as a matter of policy, I mean, these types of remedies typically would not be provided to businesses. I think they're provided to individuals in the context of Chapter 109, but because they're kind of extraordinary remedies, I think the legislature found it was unnecessary to extend them to corporations and the like, and I think that's a logical place to cut off or to extend, you know, their rather extraordinary remedies set forth in Section
134.93. Now, the argument you make in your brief, or one of the arguments, is that if you follow the definition of person, states and subdivisions of the state will be included here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, so if, how would that work? I don't quite understand it. It's my understanding in your brief, you said that if we said person includes all the defined units in 990.01, one of the defined units is a governmental entity, right?
Right.
And so you make the argument that if you substitute a government entity for independent representative, that would be absurd. And I would like you to expand on that response. Why is it absurd? That would be partly in response to Justice Prosser.
I don't think that it's logical that governmental entities such as municipalities or counties or ever intended to have rights as independent sales
representatives. Does a state have a, is compensated by commission? I mean, I don't think that states and counties would be involved here under any conditions.
Well, I think...
because it wouldn't fit another part of the definition.
I think that then what you're being asked to do is to pick and choose various definitions in section 990.01, subsection 26, and see if only certain of those provisions apply. And I think it should be a case that, given the context of this particular statute, that none of them apply because it is, as I say, illogical that the legislature chose different terms to define the same business entities. So,
Counsel, I'm still trying to make sense of this. Of your position. An independent sales representative. I could be an independent sales representative today, and I would come within the statute. And then tomorrow, I would decide for whatever reason to incorporate myself. And according to your argument now, today I'm entitled to these extraordinary damages or extraordinary remedies, but tomorrow I wouldn't be. Why?
I mean, as a corporation.
I don't put a lot of faith in all of these legislative rules, you know, or how we interpret. Our fundamental job is to try to discern the intent of the legislature. And I'm trying to discern why the legislature would intend to treat those two differently.
It may be that, you as a shareholder now have limited liability. It may be that, in view of the fact that you have limited liability, you shouldn't have these extraordinary rights. And I think it's clear that that's where the legislature set the line, and I think that's how the court should interpret the statute.
Thank you, Lord Counsel. You have 5 minutes. Mr. Fox, representing Industry to Industry, Inc. I see that you are scheduled to speak for 25 minutes, and Mr. Edkist is going to speak for 5, representing the Amicus Curiae. Is that correct?
Correct, Chief Justice. Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Fox. The name of my firm is Schmidt and Rupke, and I'm representing Industry to Industry Incorporated this morning. The purpose of the Sales Representatives Act is to protect sales representatives. It doesn't distinguish based on choice of entity of a particular sales representative. It doesn't differentiate between sales representatives who are sole proprietors, and it doesn't distinguish between sales representatives who have chosen to incorporate. So the Act extends its protection to all sales representatives, regardless of choice of entity. It's our position that any other interpretation of this law not only ignores the words of the law, but absolutely fails to give effect to any common sense reading or interpretation of the law. The primary problem with the petitioner's analysis is that it fails to first, before engaging in statutory construction, even ask what the term person means. The stark contrast argument that has become the petitioner's mantra presupposes that person is either limited to meaning natural person or is ambiguous, and it is neither. As noted by the Court of Appeals in its published opinion in this case, the dictionary defines person to include corporations. So it's our position that the language of the statute itself covers corporate sales representatives. The stark contrast argument that we continue to have heard about this morning is, again, statutory construction, and it's not permitted if the language of the statute answers the question, what does person mean? But if we do have to engage in statutory construction, analysis of the Sales Representatives Act begins, and I believe it also ends, with a certain presumption that we're required to make. The presumption is that when the legislature uses the term person in the statutes, when it's legislating what entities are covered under a specific law, the legislature is signaling us to read into that law that it means natural persons or artificial or legally fictional persons like corporations. And there are two, I think, good reasons that support that particular presumption. First of all, for generations, this court has uniformly interpreted person when used in the statutes to include corporations. And the court has done so even when the legislature has used qualifying pronouns like his, hers, or theirs. That has never made a difference to the court's interpretation of the term person in the statutes. And I'm relying on the Torres and W.S. Seaman cases that I've cited in my response. So at common law, the term person has been held to include corporations. And perhaps more importantly to the decision that the court is being asked to make today, Section 990.0126 requires or presumes that the interpretation of person includes corporate bodies or other types of business entities, as does the dictionary.
Can a corporation be an employee under 10903?
I'm not sure that a corporation can ever be an employee under any particular circumstance because of tax reasons. For example, absent that really unrelated problem, a corporation could make a wage claim under the current version of Chapter 109 because of the language employed. The legislature used the term person in defining employee exactly as the legislature used the term person in defining an employer under that statute. But again, common sense tells us that corporations can't be employees, at least I've never come across one.
Well, that's why I'm asking you that question, because if you look at 134.93, which I'm sure you've looked at a number of times, which says an independent sales rep doesn't include any of the following, and B2 says a person, again using that definition, and if you mean it means everybody. It says a person who is an employee of the principal and whose wages must be paid as required under 10903. Looks that you can't be talking about a corporation when you're talking about person there, because it's not an employee. So it seems to me that if you just look at the face of the statute, you could argue that the word person is used maybe differently in different provisions.
I think it is used differently in different provisions. I would agree with that.
Therefore, you have to look beyond just the word person as defined in 990. It's arguable. Now, another way of arguing it, therefore, we have to, it's not so clear-cut. Plain language is not so plain, and there is ambiguity. I mean, that's that argument, whether you like it or not.
It may be an argument. I don't believe it's reasonable to interpret person as ambiguous in the context of the statute. because of the very operation of the plain language rule. The corollary to the plain language rule says that the plain language rule applies in the absence of statutory definitions. And that statutory definition is employed and given to us in Chapter 990 in this case.
Another problem here is that the definition of person is not a meaning definition. It doesn't say person means A, B, and C, or A, B. It doesn't mean that. It says it includes. And the definition of person doesn't even list individual.
That's correct. Set. And it's because it says it includes.
That's right. So just by looking at person, you know you've got an ambiguous definition because you don't know what, which of that list is covered.
But it's not ambiguous because it's not telling us that these examples of person are mutually exclusive. It's not ambiguous for a statute to, like 990.01 sub 26, to include different examples. I don't think that creates an ambiguity. That tells us precisely what it can mean in 134.93. That's very precise in that.
Can, but it need not mean.
Only if that's contrary to the manifest intent after reading 990.01 sub 26 into a statute.
Does legislative history support you or not, or is it inconclusive?
I think the legislative history at best is inconclusive. I really, truly believe that it supports us. Now, one of the arguments...
Well, at best, it supports you. At best, it supports you. At worst, it's inconclusive.
That's correct. Yeah. That's my interpretation. Mr. Hutchinson has cited the court to WMC's input into the statute. WMC objected to the definition of person in the proposed amendments to Chapter 109, as again Mr. Hutchinson has told us this morning. But it didn't object because of the reasons that we've been offered. If you read the objection, first you have to read the definition. In the proposed amendments to Chapter 109, commissioned salesperson is defined very generally as a person who earns commission. In the proposed amendments to Chapter 135, we're talking about wholesale sales representatives, which is a subset. So WMC objected to the definition of commissioned salesperson in the proposed amendments because that definition didn't include any exception for retail sales representatives or sales representatives who bought on their own account. So the objection had nothing to do with choice of entity. The objection had everything to do with the kind of business the sales representative was going to transact under the proposed amendments. WMC never objected to the definition of sales representative in the proposed amendments to Chapter 135.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you, because as I read the Illinois statute, which is appended, that's the appendix at 49, seemed to me quite similar to what Wisconsin finally did adopt.
It's almost exact, certainly for purposes of the definition of sales representative and principal.
So your position is that they're talking about a different
kind of business?
They're talking about a different... The Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce are talking about a precursor to the statute that was ultimately adopted, not the definition adopted.
WMC was objecting to the definition that was proposed. It was saying, let's use the Illinois approach, if I follow your question. And I mean, let's face it, I mean, the very smart people at WMC, I believe, probably knew about the MS Kind case that interpreted the Illinois statute. I doubt they would blindly tell the legislature to adopt a statute without realizing how the law had been previously interpreted.
So that Illinois case preceded the statutory adoption?
The Illinois case was 1991. We adopted the statute in 1998. So it came substantially before that.
The assumption is you adopt the statute, you adopt the interpretation thereof. That's the general construction.
That's what this court has told us on any number of given occasions, concerning statutes adopted from other states and from federal law.
You're trusting that.
I do trust that, yeah. Now, granted, the Illinois case is a court of appeals case. It's not an Illinois Supreme Court case.
It's the law of Illinois.
It's the law of Illinois as it exists right now, yes.
Counsel, I understand your first argument to be that you look at the statute 194-93 and the plain meaning of person includes corporation. Is that your first argument?
That's my first argument.
And in discussing 990-01 with the chief, you're talking about plain meaning. But tell me what bothers me. It's my belief that if I asked everyone here a week ago, before they even heard of this case, if I would have said to them, is Enron Corporation a person? It's my belief that virtually none of them would say Enron Corporation is a person. And if my belief is correct, then your plain meaning argument is incorrect. How do you respond to that?
Again, the corollary to the plain meaning argument is that it doesn't apply where a statutory definition exists.
Okay, that's your second argument.
That's my alternative argument.
I'm just talking about your first argument. You can disagree with my premise, certainly. Do you disagree with my premise that virtually no one here a week ago had asked the question, plain meaning, give me your plain meaning, is Enron Corporation a person? I think they would have said no.
The plain meaning of a word used in a statute may not always be what a lay person thinks it may mean. That's why we have dictionaries, and that's why the appellate courts in Wisconsin have constantly told us that in interpreting the plain meaning of statutes, it is perfectly permissible, and I think it's encouraged by those decisions, to use a dictionary. And if we pick up Black's Law Dictionary or American Heritage, it will tell us that included in the meaning of person is artificial person, corporations, and natural persons. And when we think about the term natural person, only then, I think, could we have a plain meaning problem with 134.93.
So it's your understanding that even if, you may not agree with my premise, that even if the plain meaning is inconsistent with what most people would think of the plain meaning is, it's still the plain meaning.
That's what the legal term plain meaning means, I think. That's right.
Can I ask whether an insurance agency is covered by 134.93?
I think that insurance agencies clearly are accepted from application of 134.93 by the language of the statute itself. There's an exception carved out for them.
Well, I see other than an insurance agent or broker, you mean that an agent is an agency?
An agent certainly could conceivably be an agency. A one-man show or a one-woman show can be certainly an insurance agency, just like a one-person real estate broker could be a real estate brokerage. So I think you may have identified an ambiguity in that statute, but unless the term agency is defined in Chapter 990, and I don't believe it is, I think then we're going to rely on what the legislative intent might be there. And clearly, we had an insurance lobby at work in this case that was telling the legislature that it did not want to be subject to 134.93, and they prevailed on the legislature in that regard.
But if person, I think point of Justice Prosser's question, if I might, is if person meant included corporation, then why doesn't it say other than an insurance agency or brokerage company? It looks to an individual. Broker or agent looks to an individual.
I'm not sure the term broker looks to an individual. If I call my broker, I know I'm calling an insurance broker that's got approximately 25 agents working at that office. So I'm not sure. I'm conceding that there may be some ambiguity in the use of the term agency or broker.
Well, it's not that there's an ambiguity in the word agent or broker. It's that it lends ambiguity to whether person means corporation or means an individual, because you're stringing along words that seem to refer to an individual.
I looked at that issue and came across the Torres and W.S. Seaman cases, which are Supreme Court decisions that date pretty far back. And the court was specifically not concerned, expressly not concerned, with qualifying terms like who or hers or his. The court relied on what it knew to be the plain meaning or common law definition of person to include corporate and other business type entities.
Why should we decide this case different from, Missouri?
Country Motors?
Missouri.
There's a very good reason for that. There's a very subtle difference in the Missouri statute as compared to the Wisconsin statute. And even though it is very subtle, and I can't tell you how many times I read that case before I realized that there was a difference, that subtle distinction is determinative of the outcome in the Missouri case. Missouri says that a sales representative is a person who solicits wholesale orders on behalf of a principal. It then says a principal is a person, corporation, association, or other business entity. On the one hand, it used the term person in defining a sales representative. On the other hand, it also used the term person in defining a principal. So the court in Missouri said that the only reason person could be used in defining principal was to mirror the definition.
Representative. And that the listing of business entities after the word person in the definition of principal would be surplusage and would take all meaning away from use of the word person in the definition of principal. Now,
well, our definition of principal talks about sole proprietorship. Isn't that a person?
A sole proprietor is a natural person. It's not a person. It can be, but a sole proprietorship is an individual. It's not a corporate entity. And again, I think a very subtle distinction, but also determinative of the outcome in this case, because if sole proprietorship truly means sole proprietorship, and I think it does, then the word person in our statute indicates to me to have a broader and different meaning than the word sole proprietorship, especially if we give credence to the argument that when the legislature uses different terms in a statute, it means different things. So I think that that determines the outcome in this case. And even more so, the decision in the city of Madison versus Highland Hall was decided with a statute that is much more like the Missouri statute, that in that it uses the word person in defining a potential plaintiff on the one hand and in defining a defendant on the other hand. So I'm not sure that this court could accept the ruling in the Missouri case without implicitly overruling what it did in the City of Madison versus Highland Hall case.
So this would be like Missouri if it said principal means a person, comma, sole proprietorship, partnership, joint venture, blah, blah, blah.
Then the definitions would mirror those used in the different statute in Missouri. That's correct. But again, if that statute is analyzed under the analysis of City of Madison versus Highland Hall, I don't think this court, again, could accept the Missouri ruling without overruling what it did in City of Madison case. And that's a case where the court looked to 990.01 sub 26, even though there was an internal definition of what person meant in the antitrust statute.
I think there's a reason that the legislature could provide that independent sales representative be an individual rather than a corporation. And that is, the assumption is made that an individual relies on earnings, commissions, or wages, whereas a corporation, rightly or wrongly, the assumption is made it has assets upon which it can fall back if it's not paid immediately, whereas an individual might not. And that's why you got the wage statute 109.03, and that's why you got 134.93.
If that's the assumption that's being made, I think it's truly an unreasonable assumption. And the best way to illustrate that is Justice Babbage's example earlier, and that's that one day one person could be operating a sole proprietorship and the next day, on the advice of counsel, decides to incorporate. There's absolutely no difference in the substantive relationship between principal and sales representative in that case, and I would think that the assumption that this newfound corporation had other assets to fall back on in the case of a termination would be unreasonable in that case.
Sure. There are lots of corporations that have no assets, or not only don't they have assets, they have more liabilities than their assets. But still, the general assumption is that that a corporate entity has the wherewithal to withstand several months or weeks or years, maybe, of not getting paid.
In this day and age, I can't conceive of a reason why, for business purposes, an individual who incorporates should be treated any differently from an individual who doesn't incorporate, or any corporation for that matter. That goes to the equal protection analysis. There's absolutely no reason that the petitioner has presented or that I can think of that would support or be a rational basis for treating individuals differently from corporations in the context of the Sales Representatives Act. I will grant you that on different occasions, this court and the Court of Appeals has decided that individuals can be treated differently than corporations. But those are almost, the case has almost become anecdotal in the context of a brand new, totally different statute in a totally different context. So we're still required to come up with a rational basis. And in this case, the primary argument that I've heard from the petitioner is that a corporation has contract rights that protect it, and those are the same contract rights that protect an individual. So therefore, that's a distinction to be made which supports the differing treatment of the law as the petitioner interprets it, and quite frankly, that's not even a distinction. That's a similarity. So that is not a basis on which to differentiate corporations from individuals in this case. It's a basis to treat them the same because the corporation has the same rights that an individual has, absent the statute. The only other argument that I recall being made in support of the rational basis for the statute was that a corporation has limited liability for its debts and obligations, a sole proprietor, an individual doesn't. I think it's a bit of a red herring because that's a contrast between a shareholder and a sole proprietor. And a shareholder isn't covered by the Sales Representative Act. It's the corporation that's covered by the Sales Representative Act. So it's a case of comparing apples to oranges.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Your time is over.
Thank
and
you.
We'll hear from Mr. Edquist. Ron Breezen, Pertell, and Roper, representing the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers Agents.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson and members of the court. I'd like to thank Mr. Fox for offering 5 minutes of his time to the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers Agents, and I would like to thank the court for granting that motion. So much to say and so little time. 2 points that I would like to make during my brief remarks. The first is that the genesis for the Sales Representative Act comes from SB 226's proposed amendments to Chapter 135, not Chapter 109, which I think has been the source of much confusion here this morning. That is critical because there is absolutely no question that the proposed amendments to Chapter 135 clearly contemplated that persons included corporations. The second point that I want to make this morning, now this afternoon almost, is that there are several bad policy reasons underlying Mr. Hutchinson's remarks. Three that I would like to touch on as I go through my remarks. First, the legislative history. What I would suggest that the court do is to look at Section 134.93, look at the remedies, look at the provisions, and line them up to the provisions that were in the proposed amendments to Chapter 109 and the proposed amendments to Chapter 135. And what you will see is that the Sales Representative Act, as enacted, came from those proposed amendments to Chapter 135. Let me give you some examples. First, the language itself. The proposed amendments to Chapter 135 dealt with sales representatives, as does the Sales Representative Act itself, not commissioned salespersons. Second, as noted by Mr. Fox, the Sales Representative Act protections only extend to persons who are soliciting orders for wholesale. The Sales Representative Act and the proposed amendments to Chapter 135 are exactly consistent in that regard. Not so the proposed amendments to Chapter 109, which dealt with a panoply of different potential individuals. In fact, the point that Mr. Hutchinson was making regarding Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce actually goes to this very point. If you look at that memorandum with respect to Justice Sykes' comments, the relevance of that is that it was referred to by Senator Grobschmidt. It clearly indicates what was in his mind as they were moving from the original SB 226 to the Senate substitute amendment.
But yes. We don't enforce what's in the mind of members of the legislature. We enforce the statute that they wrote. And so this foray into legislative history is illegitimate.
Well, I don't know that it's illegitimate. I think it's instructive. It certainly isn't controlling, because what you see as you look through it is Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce was saying, look, you've got two different provisions. You look at the last page of the memorandum, they're saying there's an anomaly here. On the one hand, you're dealing with Chapter 109, which is dealing with, in part, potentially these independent contractors, but a lot of other people. And in Chapter 135, you're dealing with these wholesale persons, and they're not challenging whether that should include corporations. And they're saying, you know what, for both of those, we think the better approach is Illinois. So let's look then again at how do they line up. I've mentioned 2 points. A third one, Chapter 135, those proposed amendments. And they had proposed advance notification of termination, competitive change of circumstances. You find that in the act as enacted. Nothing like that at all in Chapter 109. Finally, Chapter 109 was clearly trying to deal with these issues as wage claims, a totally different kind of a structure than what Chapter 135 proposed and what the actual Sales Representative Act as enacted proposed, which is dealing with a contractual relationship between the principals and the reps. Totally different. The significance, again, if you look back to the extent that you think a legislative analysis is at all important, the line that you trace back doesn't take you to Chapter 109. It takes you to Chapter 135, where clearly there was an intent to include corporations within the definition of persons. And in fact, if the intent was to protect, as Mr. Hutchinson would suggest, if the Sales Representative Act was intended to protect those people who were these commissioned salespersons out there selling at retail, well, I've got bad news. The Sales Representative Act still doesn't cover them, because it only deals with those persons who are soliciting orders for wholesale. Second point, if I may, Judge, the red light is on, public policy briefly. Three things. First, if you adopt Mr. Hutchinson's point, you force sales representatives to choose. Do they take advantage of what the legislator is giving them, the benefits of the corporate form of enterprise? Or do they choose to go as individuals just so that they can take advantage of the Sales Representative Act provisions? Nothing suggested in the legislative history that that kind of Hobson's choice, the term we heard in the last argument, would be present here. Second, Mr. Hutchinson's proposal actually provides an incentive for principals to refuse to deal with individuals. Given a choice, if you're a principal, are you going to deal with individuals where you're subject to the Sales Representative Act? Or are you going to deal with corporations where you don't have to worry about it? So this interpretation turns around and bites in the back end the very people that supposedly are being protected. That makes no sense. Finally, this approach turns the whole policy of the Sales Representative Act on its head. Instead of equalizing the bargaining power between sales reps and principals, it gives principals more power. In fact, it protects principals rather than protecting sales reps. I leave you with a question Justice Babbage asked to Mr. Hutchinson. Why? Why? What possible rationale could there be for that approach? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson.
First, with respect to the MS Kine case, there is no mention of the MS Kine case in what was being used to promote what became Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1 by the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association. The MS Kine case was a situation where the manufacturer, by the time the case got up on appeal, did not enter an appearance, did not make any arguments, and I don't think that it should be persuasive argument, persuasive precedent for this court. Second, with respect to whether or not what became Senate Substitute Amendment Number 1 was had its genesis in either the provisions of Chapter 109 or the genesis and the provisions that were to amend Chapter 135. I think, at least insofar as the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association was concerned, they thought that they were making modifications to the provisions in Chapter 109. And if that were in the original bill, if this court would look at the Legislative Reference Bureau's description of the provisions that were originally intended to amend Chapter 109, the court will see that throughout those provisions, the Legislative Reference Bureau was referring to words such as his and hers, and I think it's real clear that the part of the bill that was originally intended to amend Chapter 109 was strictly going to be applicable to persons, and I think those folks that were promoting the substitute amendment thought that it was strictly applicable to persons, too. With respect to the DeWeese case, which is this Missouri case, I think in the context of the DeWeese case, the fact that the Missouri statute used the word person in the definition of principal, whereas in Wisconsin we use the word sole proprietor, is not a distinction whatsoever. Obviously, persons that operate their own business are sole proprietors, and I think that it is a synonym in the context of this case, whether it be sole proprietor or person, I think they are synonymous in the context of this situation.
Can I ask you whether Hillsman is a principal under the statute?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Is Hillsman Modular a principal under the statute?
I think so. Hillsman Modular Molding is a corporation which is a manufacturer in Florida.
But principals only deal with independent sales representatives.
That's under C2.
In that regard, I thought you meant aside from the fact that whether or not they had a contract with the independent sales representative. I misunderstood your question. They are a corporation which is a manufacturer in Titusville, Florida. In this context, I don't think they have a contract with the independent sales representative as defined by the statute.
Do they have contracts with individuals who are independent sales representatives? Or they only deal with corporations?
I'm not sure. In other states, I'm not sure of the answer to that.
The contract in this case was originally with an individual, was it not?
Well.
And never updated after incorporation?
There was, I don't believe that is the contract that is in question. If you're referring to a 1971 contract with Mr. Peter Fantel, I don't think that contract is, in fact, the contract that is applicable to this case.
Is there a different one?
I think there is a course of dealing as between Industry to Industry, Inc., and Hillsman Modular Molding after the current principal shareholder of Industry to Industry formed his corporation in, I think, 1986 or 87, something like that. I think that is that course of dealing which constitutes a contract as such, not some sort of written paper from 1971 that, in my mind, is not applicable.
If you wish, you may summarize argument.
In the end, I think I agree with the court that the court should look at the plain language. I think in the context of this case, it's also worthwhile to look at the legislative history because I think it sheds light on the manifest intent of the legislature. I think if the court looks at the definition of principal in comparison with the definition of independent sales representative, the court will see that the definition of principal is broader than the definition of independent sales representative. And I think by comparison, the logical conclusion is that, in fact, the legislature did not intend to include the same business entities in both the definition of principal and the definition of independent sales representative, but simply chose to use different terms to define the same business entities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Thank you, Mr. Edquist. Thank you, Mr. Fox.